Hello and welcome to Press TV's debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. While Saudi Arabia continues to pound civilians in Yemen, Ansarullah has increased its retaliatory attacks, and now it has hit the heart of Riyadh's bread and butter, the Aramco oil refinery. Using 10 drones, Yemen's Ansarullah launched retaliatory attacks and have disrupted oil production at the largest processing plant in the world. We seem to be seeing a shift in the war, that now the Houthis are launching effective attacks inside of Saudi Arabia.
The world's largest oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia and a major oil field operated by Saudi Aramco came under drone attacks on Saturday morning. A huge blaze engulfed the targeted positions, and explosions could be heard from kilometers away. Yemen's Ansarullah movement and allied army forces claim responsibility for the attacks.
This mission comes as part of our legitimate and natural right to react to the crimes of the aggression and its continuous blockade on our country for the past 5 years.
Yahya Saria said unmanned aerial vehicles targeted Aramco facilities in Bughaik and Al Khurais. He said the attacks were in retaliation for Saudi war on Yemen. The Saudi Interior Ministry has confirmed the attacks. The spokesman for the Yemeni army also warned that the attacks against the kingdom would get worse if the war in Yemen continued. Yemen has been under attack by a coalition led by Saudi Arabia since March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and sparked famine and diseases across the impoverished Arab country. The United Nations has branded the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yemenis have launched a series of drone and missile attacks over the past few months, targeting Saudi airbases and other facilities. Experts believe that recent attacks are a serious blow to the Saudi economy.
The one thing that Saudi Arabia cannot take and cannot continue to suffer is when their bread and butter, their economic lifeline, is being bombed.
But the economic impact of the attacks is not the only problem Saudi Arabia is facing. Riyadh lost an ally in its campaign against Sana'a in late June when the United Arab Emirates announced scaling back its military presence in Yemen. Then in August, the UAE-backed separatists took control of the southern city of Aden, the base of the Saudi-backed government. The move led to a series of infighting between Saudi-backed groups and militants supported by the UAE, and carried a clear message. There is a deepening rift between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. When Saudi Arabia waged a war against its southern neighbor, it was under the impression that the war will end within weeks, given the fact that it was carrying out airstrikes on Yemenis day and night and a blockade was imposed on Yemeni borders. But 4.5 years later, the Yemeni resistance has not broken. Instead, it seems that Riyadh is losing allies and it stands on a fragile position, which is threatening both its security and economy.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane, out of Washington, D.C., and historian and journalist, Brett Jonkers, out of Belgium. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in D.C. And Michael, when Saudi Arabia initiated its war on Yemen, Saudi rulers didn't think it would take very long to control Yemen. However, 4.5 years later, not only have the Saudis not attained that goal, the kingdom is being attacked by the Houthis now at will. Your analysis of this situation?
Well, I think you're spot on there. When this whole thing started, as you mentioned, 4.5 years ago, it was expected to be something of a fast, easy prosecution of a campaign that would result in restoration of the president of Yemen, and everything would go back to the way it was originally. That clearly hasn't happened. As your setup piece and as you noted, in the last several months, The Houthis, with new technology and new weapons and new capabilities, have been able to prosecute the campaign inside of Saudi Arabia's borders. This is what they've been trying to avoid by keeping them pushed back away from the border. And I think that we've now entered a new phase where this can happen almost at will. The Saudis are going to have to very carefully evaluate what their defensive positions are, what their key assets are that they need to protect. It appears there are conflicting reports as to the damage done in this particular strike, but the Saudis are saying they should be up and pumping within a couple days. That would lead us to believe that it's a relatively minor amount of damage, but whether it is or it isn't, they have to expect that there will be more of these kinds of strikes, and even if this one was a lighter damage strike, a future one will create significantly more damage in the future. The Saudis really have to evaluate what the targets are that they want to protect and how they're going to do it.
Hmm. Well, Brett, what is the root reason behind the Saudis' failure to win this war against the Yemeni people? Were definitely not equipped or armed in the way that the Saudi war machine is?
Well, I think that one of the major problems, one of the major mistakes that the Saudis made is the age-old problem of underestimating one's enemy. The Saudis have basically, indeed, they went into this conflict 4.5 years ago with the mentality of being, like they used to say, we'll be home by Christmas, you know, mm-hmm. to say it with a Western figure of speech.
Mm-hmm.
But this is basically because the only thing they looked at is the amount of weaponry they have, and Saudi Arabia, of course, has the biggest, most expensive, and most technologically advanced weaponry in the Arab world. And of course, compared that then to the poorest nation in the Arab world, which is Yemen. What of course they did not keep into account at all is things like, you know, popular will, you know, popular support, the tenacity of the Yemeni people, and how a people under siege will react to a massive attack of this magnitude, which has absolutely no regard for civilian lives, which carries out indiscriminate bombings on civilian targets day and night, as has been said indeed. And what happened instead of this quick surrender, what happened is that the Yemeni people, or at least a significant part of the Yemeni people, the majority, at least in the areas in the north and in the west of Yemen, where the majority of Yemeni people live, have taken up arms and have rallied behind the National Salvation Government in Sana'a and have rallied behind Ansar Allah. This doesn't necessarily mean that they are all, you know, Ansar Allah members. That's why I don't like using the term the Houthis when we're talking about the Yemeni resistance. But this is a sort of, let's say, coalition of people who rally behind the flag, so to say, in order to defeat what they perceive to be, and what I believe indeed is, an external aggressor who seeks to impose its will on the Yemeni people without consulting, you know, their opinion on anything.
Well, Michael, what is the significance of Ansar Allah being able to hit inside of Saudi Arabia, and especially oil refineries, and it seems at will? I mean, what are the Saudis going to do? What do you think is necessary at this point?
Well, it becomes a military puzzle that they have to solve relatively quickly. They can take the fight to the Houthis inside Yemen if they can locate through intelligence and other methodologies where the weapons, the rockets, the drone centers are, and try and take them out. They can try and disrupt the supply lines that bring these weapons to the Houthis and keep them from acquiring them in the first place. Or they can go ahead and escalate their conflict with Iran, who they believe are the suppliers of these weapons, and see if they can cause some sort of incident or distraction or circumstances where Iran will not have the ability to keep the Houthis supplied with these weapons. There are other options as well, but those are the big ones. And then the fourth one, of course, is they need to shore up their defenses. They need to know exactly where these attacks are coming, when they're coming, so that they can prevent them. I would imagine, I've read reports already, that although there was some softening in the cohesiveness of their coalition. It seems to be back together again as a result of this particular attack, as the Saudi-led coalition understands that if Saudi Arabia's oil capacity is significantly damaged, that that's something for the whole world to deal with, and nobody really wants to see that. The last thing is, I would expect to see Saudi Arabia come to the United States and ask for help in terms of reconnaissance, intel, target selection, things like that. I would expect President Trump to be somewhat receptive to those requests.
Well, Brett, your take on all of this, as far as the psychological and financial, we look at those two areas, the type of effects that these types of attacks will have on the Saudis. Let's look at it from the psychological perspective, of course, going into this, as you had said earlier, and thinking that they were well equipped and would take everyone out in very quickly. And obviously, 4.5 years later, they have not been able to do that. What does it do to the psyche of those actually now fighting the Yemenis?
Well, I would imagine it is morale shattering. It will destroy the morale at this point, of course, of many in the Saudi army. Of course, the Saudi regime itself, the Saudi kingdom, will remain at least act unfazed. But we know for a fact, you know, the analyses have confirmed, and you see there is footage on the ground that the Saudi army, when they're in the field fighting against Yemen, they have a massive problem and a massive lack of morale, a massive lack of discipline, and a massive fear of basically fighting the Yemeni people and the soldiers of the Yemeni army. Especially being because of the fact, of course, that many of these soldiers are in fact foreign mercenaries who don't really have any real, you know, reason other than a financial incentive to be there in the first place. So when Saudi Arabia now gets hit in its very heartland, and this is not the first time, there have been similar attacks before. There have been similar attacks on Saudi oil refineries, even water installations. There have been attacks very near to the border between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And of course, let's also talk about, when we talk psychologically, let's talk about where these things are located. These oil refineries are located in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia. They're located not very far from the Persian Gulf. In fact, the nearest countries, let's say, that border towards are like Bahrain and Qatar. So this is not anywhere close by Yemen itself. This is on the completely other side of the peninsula. And yet somehow these drones, these domestically produced drones, have penetrated Saudi Arabia's defenses and traveled for all these hundreds of miles in order to hit the biggest oil refinery in the world. And this is the reason, of course, why this is news, is because it's such a strategically important target. But one thing that is not often reported in international news, and one of the reasons being that it happens so often, is the attacks, the constant Yemeni attacks that are going on in the southern provinces, in what used to be Greater Yemen, Jaizan, Najran, and Asir provinces. The provinces in the south of Saudi Arabia, where bases like the airbase of Khamis Mushayt and the international airport at Abba in the Asir region, they have been attacked dozens of times. Mm-hmm. The last few months, there has been basically an attack going on once or twice or more a week with missiles and with drone attacks, attacking these air bases of Saudi Arabia in the south. So this combined with this this massively successful attack is absolutely shattering to the psychology and to the morale of an aggressor state, because Saudi Arabia, at the end of the day, they know they have nothing really to fear from Yemen. This is not a war on terror. This is not a defense of the Saudi borders or anything. This has nothing to do with the defense of Saudi Arabia. This has everything to do with them imposing their will on a foreign independent nation, and they're losing that war. Mm-hmm. As has been shown by this attack.
Well, Michael, the Saudi coalition with the UAE is falling apart, and despite the kingdom's support from the United States and Israel, Riyadh is not able to escape this quagmire that it has created in Yemen, and the kingdom has spent so much money on this war. So why doesn't Riyadh just try to end the war? What's keeping them involved?
Well, candidly, I think Riyadh believes that if they were to just withdraw and say, sorry about that, we didn't mean it, can't we all just live in peace, the answer would be no. Riyadh believes that the Houthi rebels once they fully establish themselves as the power to be in Yemen, they will then turn themselves north and they will continue to prosecute their attack against Saudi Arabia. The reason that this started in the first place was so Saudi could keep the conflict south of that border, and now we find out that they can't keep that conflict south of the border. If they militarily withdraw from all operations south of the Saudi-Yemenis border, then 100% of the continued war and conflict will be inside Saudi Arabia territory, and they're doing everything they can to avoid that.
Well, Brett, the United States have been offering technical support to the Saudis during their war on the people of Yemen. How likely are we to see Washington and even London become more involved in this war as Ansarullah continues to be effective with targeting oil-rich regions of Saudi Arabia?
Of course, the interesting thing now is that this is happening right after a very popular, very well-known, let's say, neocon war hawk, John Bolton, has recently been fired as National Security Advisor.
Yes.
So this might be, it might be interesting to see how the cabinet reshuffle and the potential loss of influence by the neocon war hawks will affect the policy of Washington DC in this conflict. There have been signs already that many within the US establishment and even including President Trump himself are basically getting tired of having to prop up Saudi Arabia in a what threatens to be another, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq war scenario that can drag on for God knows how long. So when those the signs that we have been seeing are mildly positive, there have been some good signs, especially now that there has been increased pressure from the Senate and House of Representatives from both parties, both Republican and Democrat, asking for the United States to actually stop supporting Saudi Arabia. In fact, there have been votes upon this twice already. It has even passed the House of Representatives in the past, only to be vetoed. So this pressure that is building on the United States, again, to say, because a lot of these representatives in the U.S., who are asking the U.S. to stop, you know, funding the Saudi war against Yemen, they are not pro-Yemeni, pro-Ansarullah, pro-Shia, or anything at all. But they are basically saying, you know, Ansarullah is not on our terrorist watch list. There is no reason, you know, to accuse them of terrorism. There is no real motive for the United States and no real benefit for the United States to be had here. If Yemen were to take the fight to the southern provinces and try to take the southern provinces of Saudi Arabia, you know, back to form a greater Yemen, that's a different story. But for the time being, for many people in the United States, I think they're starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, this is a war that for the U.S., they have nothing to win there. Mm-hmm. If Yemen gets destroyed by Saudi Arabia, you know, the U.S. doesn't benefit from it. And if Yemen wins in this war, the U.S. won't necessarily lose anything into this conflict.
Okay,
either.
Let me get Michael into this discussion. Your take on that, Michael, now that we've seen one less hawk in the U.S. administration, how likely are we going to see a change on the horizon from Washington and how it's dealing with Yemen?
I don't think so. I think President Trump is invested with Saudi Arabia. His entire presidency has been marked by agreements and deals with Saudi Arabia. He gets along with Crown Prince Salman very, very well. Even the Khashoggi incident was not able to derail that partnership that they have. The departure of John Bolton, I don't think, is going to have a significant influence on the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia during the presidency of Donald Trump. Yes, we had a vote in the United States Senate a couple months ago that was aimed at trying to get the United States to de-partner with Saudi Arabia in its war with the Houthi rebels. President Trump just brushed that aside like it was just an annoyance to him. The circumstances really are that this is a really global strategic issue that we're facing.
Okay.
Who's going to be responsible for the security of Saudi Arabia? And I believe Donald Trump is completely invested in that.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this debate. Founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane out of Washington, and historian and journalist Mike Junkers out of Belgium. Thank you both for being with us. And as always, I appreciate all our viewers being with us for another debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.